Hey, this is Traces, and you're listening to Endeavors.
Head up, smile to your crowd, eyes forward, hands down. Reckless, trying to be seen, don't say what you really mean. But maybe you're onto me, maybe I'm alone, and I always wait to see if something else goes wrong. Maybe you're onto me, maybe I'm alone, maybe I'm alone.
Hello and welcome to Endeavors. You just heard Traces with IDBH, and the man himself, Traces, will be on a little bit later. But it will be a good show today. In addition to Traces, there's a lovely interview with a comedian turned science presenter. Him and I kind of joked about the fact that not only is he British, but he's a humanist and talks about science. And I think there's a stereotype that because he's British, anything he says sounds intelligent and he sounds smarter than the rest of us, which he probably is, given the fact that he presents science. His name is Robin Ince. And he got a start in comedy by opening for his really good friend, Ricky Gervais. You may have heard of him. But now he's doing really, really interesting work. He hosts a show in the UK, a BBC radio show called The Infinite Monkey Cage, with physicist Professor Brian Cox. He was actually just in town yesterday presenting a show with probably Canada's top science presenter and intellectual, the former astronaut Chris Hadfield. But he's also done many other things. He presented BBC Radio 4's Serious About Comedy, where panelists include Josie Long, Howard Reed, and Natalie Haynes. He supports the Rationalist Association and organizes events for them at the Bloomsbury Theater. He also started as a comedy writer working on the 11 o'clock show as an impressionist, and additionally appeared on the original British version of The Office. He is Robin Ince, and I spoke with him last week about his life and career. Robin Ince, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Very happy to join you.
So you started off doing comedy clubs, you were at the Edinburgh Festival, you toured a lot with Ricky Gervais, and now you're co-hosting science shows and sort of becoming the go-to guy for a lot of science talk. How did that career evolution come about for you?
Well, I think it was probably in the first 10 years, because I started in 1992, in the first 10 years, I always knew I wanted to be a stand-up, and then eventually I thought, what do I actually want to do with stand-up? So I had 10 years of working as a stand-up, and then in about 15 years ago, I started to think, well, I'm always interested in science, I don't know very much about it, I should start trying to put on shows that don't exist. That was a lot of what it was looking at pop culture, what's not out there in pop culture. And I decided that rather than trying to do what you think you're meant to do to become a successful comedian, I should just do what I want to do and just do fun stuff. Mainly ideas where people went, well, that won't catch on. That'll be a disaster. So I've generally moved towards areas where early predictions have been, don't go there. No one wants to see that kind of stuff. And so I started just mucking around with different ideas of variety. I did the show called The Book Club, which was kind of a celebration of weird novels about giant killer crab invasions on Earth and strange books of advice of how to get married. And I would include in that accordion players and mime artists, but kind of quite anarchic mime artists. And people who'd made strange costumes out of felt. Like, there was a great team that used to do a character called Elivis, who was the elephant man Elvis, that meant it was an Elvis Presley with neurofibromatosis and a Hessian sack on his head. And then I started thinking as well about how much more I could develop ideas of getting scientists on stage. So you get someone coming to watch a comedian or a musician, and then you sneak in a physicist, and they kind of go, oh, I didn't think science was my thing, but that was pretty interesting, that stuff about black holes. So that was my idea, was always just to try and create lots of things that I personally would like to see, ridiculous and stupid ideas.
And I know in the early part of your career you became good friends with and opened for Ricky Gervais, who's also a bit of a science buff. How much talk was there in the downtime about science and different biological things that were happening at the time?
Well, do you know what? At the time, the main biological thing that was going on was actually more psychological, with his desire to torture me on tour. He is like an emperor, an 18th century emperor, who merely wants to have the most fun, how pain and agony his subjects go through. So on the tour, I was buried on beaches and hung upside down on things and all manner of stuff. But it was, so on tour, generally, he was just doing things to stop being bored. But then when we weren't on tour and we were just in normal places, that's when he does like talking about different ideas of, I mean, for instance, recently he started doing this thing called Deadly Serious, which is a kind of mixture of music and guests, people like Richard Dawkins. And that's been really weird for me, because for most of my time with him, I've known him for 25 years. He screeches, makes weird noises, but now he's reached a new stage of his career where he's kind of wants to talk very seriously about things. So I sat with him and Richard Dawkins, with him going, so, you know, Richard, explain to me more about ideas of the selfish gene and why you think that was misunderstood. And all the way through, I'm thinking, why doesn't he make weird noises at Richard Dawkins? Why does he only make weird noises at me? But yeah, he's now moved into, I think, a kind of more serious mode. And I think that's in his stand-up as well, his most recent one, Humanity. He's reached that point now where he thinks it's a lot of fun annoying people, being, you know, a lot of his stand-up, he deliberately pushed people just slightly out of their comfort area. And I think now he's moved into a slightly more scientific and pragmatic area.
You know, you host a science podcast with Professor Brian Cox, and there's a lot of other ones. Star Talk comes to mind, that's co-hosted by comedians. Seth MacFarlane funded the new Cosmos. Do you see what kind of relationship do you see between science and being funny?
Well, I think comedians would have an interest in being scientists, but none of the tenacity. I mean, comedians are flibbertigibbets, and you see an idea and you go, wow, that's brilliant, I want to talk about that. And then before you've even finished talking about that, you've seen another shiny thing. So they like the element of curiosity in science, but they wouldn't spend the 30 years working in a subterranean laboratory repeatedly slamming different bundles of particles together to try and understand the Higgs field or the Higgs boson. So I think what they share is the excitement and the curiosity of trying to understand why we are as we are, why the universe is as it is.
There's kind of a joke, at least here in North America, that anytime a British person says something, no matter what they say, it sounds smarter than us. How do you feel about that stereotype?
Well, I feel that the politics that we're going through in the United Kingdom, we are really trying to refute that with incredible speed. We are going through a very strange political time, as of course, you know, a little bit south of you down in the USA. You know, we're going through strange political times where the trolls seem to have taken charge. But I do find it interesting that somehow there is this reputation, I think an undeserved reputation, because we're not a particularly serious nation. And in fact, in the UK, there's not as much respect as I think there should be for, you know, the truly academic people. But there are a lot of people who aren't, but you are right. We do have, there's something about, I noticed when I used to play in New York clubs, in particular, the last gig of the evening, when I was a bit tired and it looked like the audience might be slightly feisty, I would become just a little bit more English. I would talk a little bit more specifically and underline certain words in the hope that I'd bring back some kind of colonial respect from the old days. So I do know that the accent carries with it a myth, but a useful myth. And you're right, I can get away with talking balderdash in a way which I think other people couldn't. I mean, the guy who I think got away with swearing most on British television had a tremendously posh accent. So, you know, I think now it used to be Kenneth Tynan, who was a great theatre critic. He was the first person, I don't know what your rules are, by the way, on swearing, so I won't actually say it, but he was the first person to swear properly on television. Then Stephen Fry, I think, now has the record for the most swears in 1 minute. And that's because Stephen Fry spoke in a Stephen Fry way, and people thought, well, it does seem that he's saying rude words, but he's saying them in such an authoritative way, we'll accept him.
And you're obviously you're coming to Toronto next week to co-host a show with the great Chris Hadfield, who Canada loves. What can we look forward to about this particular show?
Well, what I particularly enjoy about it, I did the first one. The second one I failed to make it because what happened in Canada was the second one was 2 days after Donald Trump had become president. And I think you were worried that most of the same people of the USA were going to invade your borders and desperately try and take find some solace in Canada. So you changed your immigration 48 hours before I left, and I couldn't manage to get to Canada. But the first time that I came, it was just, it's a mixture where you, it's a jamboree, it's a variety show. It is lots of different ideas of stunts and tricks and experiments and comedy, and it is what I like about certainly the first time they ever did Generator, you were just bombarded by so many things. There was a guy who was quadriplegic who has pioneered this incredible metal frame which allows him to walk standing upright, you know. And he walked on stage in that. And then we had a guy whose name I forget now, had this brilliant thing where he had taken a bicycle. And I don't know if you've ever seen this. He had changed it so that when you turned the handlebars to the right, the wheel went to the left and vice versa. Now, how long do you think that would take to adapt to that, to be able to ride that bicycle without falling off?
Depends on how adept you are at riding a bike, I guess.
Do you know what? It doesn't even matter in that. It's not even about how good you are at riding a bike. It really is weeks and weeks and weeks. Once you're an adult with an adult brain, and it was amazing. We did it actually the night before the show. We were around at Chris's house and we had a few drinks. We went, let's try the bike. And everyone, when they watch someone fall off, immediately goes, well, that person just can't ride a bike. You wait till I get on the bike. Now, even Chris Hadfield, the most beloved astronaut of Canada, even when he did it, and that was a great moment in the show, actually. Someone came out of the audience to try it, and she fell off almost immediately. But I thought, the audience are watching and going, maybe she can't ride a bike that well. But if I now make Chris Hadfield try and ride that bike, if he falls off that bike, people go, if our astronaut falls off that bike, that must be a tough thing to do. So it's that kind of thing, you know, it's different stunts, it's tricks, different things that will hopefully change the way that you look at the universe and the way you approach ideas.
Do you find that Canada's sensibilities maybe are a little more attuned with Britain's attitudes and Britain's approach to comedy and life than an American audience might be?
It's quite difficult for me to say in some ways, because when I've been to the US touring there, of course, the kind of audiences you get in some ways already are a very specific group of people. You know, they are the what I would call the in the best way, the nerds, the librarians, the goths, you know, the interested and the peculiar people. But I love Canada and I love coming to Canada. And as a huge fan of David Cronenberg as well, it means that every time I look at an apartment block, I get a kind of frisson of excitement when I think about, you know, what David Cronenberg has imagined goes on in there. But I do think you're right. There is a different cultural attitude. And I think in some ways it's every time I come to Canada, because things are going a bit weird in the UK, I do think, can I just stay here? I think there is that sensibility. I think it's, you know, as I wander around and like some of the, you know, the brilliant bookshops in Toronto and the art gallery, I feel very content and at home there.
And I know you're also an atheist, which is quite common, I hear amongst actors and comedians, but it seems to be, I don't know, heightened, I guess, in the world of British comedy. Do you think there's a specific reason for that? Is God an easy target? Is there, go back to what you were saying about that relationship between science and comedy?
It's interesting, actually, because I think overall it probably looks like it's a much bigger thing than it really is in UK comedy. There are, you know, and especially because of someone like Ricky Gervais, or alternatively the Australian comedian Tim Minchin, when he was UK-based, did some incredible work. I think now we've kind of reached this point where most people, they don't care very much as long as you're kind. I mean, that was the interesting thing with the atheist boom. There was this point where I think about 10 years ago, when things like the God Delusion came out, lots of people thought, hey, wow, this is a whole movement. And if I'm an atheist and they're an atheist, we must have loads in common. And then you find out that actually not believing in God doesn't necessarily then mean you have a unifying set of ethics. It turns out there's a lot of atheists that I can't stand and some Quakers and Anglicans that I get on very well with. But I think there was certainly a period where there was a movement which in some ways is now broadening out and going into its own little subcultures. But yeah, you're right. There were a lot of mouthy comedians on the circuit. And I used to do a show called Nine Lessons and Carols for Godless People, because I'd been on a TV show where I'd argued with this religious fundamentalist who kept saying, "You want to ban Christmas?" And I said, "I don't want to ban Christmas. I like Christmas. Christmas is great." And so I thought, well, just to annoy him even more, I'll do this show, which is all just celebrating the wonder of the universe, and I'll do it at Christmas. And that's almost, in fact, where all these shows kind of came out of. It came out of an argument with a religious fundamentalist. So sometimes religious fundamentalism can lead to good. But I mean, not in itself.
Right.
It really has to be your reaction to it. Hang on, I've just suddenly realised, taken out of context, this could be a terrible thing. I won't get through immigration now if I've said that.
Well, this is Canada. You might be all right. Speaking of, you know, fundamentalism and the human species, I've heard you describe us and a lot of other different forms of living creatures as, rather than being the best, as being the least worst, and ideas having different levels of wrong. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, it's something that we've talked about a lot with in the Infinite Monkey Cage, the show that I do with Professor Brian Cox, and something that we say a lot when we're touring as well, which is to get people to understand that sometimes, especially with things like ideas like climate change, you will get those who criticise the science of climate change by going, "Oh, well, scientists were wrong about this or wrong about this." And it kind of makes science out to be a dogma, whereas, of course, in fact, what science is coming up with the least wrong answer for the time being with the means that we have at our disposal. So every time that we get, you know, a new level of understanding about the universe, whether it's Newton's ideas or then Newton's ideas are then moved on and changed by Einstein's ideas, you know, that people will say, for instance, that Newton was wrong. Einstein was right, Newton was wrong. Turns out, you know, Newton was right up to a point. And then Einstein showed that you get to a scale where he is no longer correct. But Newton was still right enough to come up with the system that we used to fly human beings to the moon. So in terms of coming up with the equations, when I say the system, sorry, I said that in a very cat-handed way, but it was through equations, his techniques, that we did the equations that led to human beings landing on the moon. So in terms of being wrong, that's not a bad wrong. If you're wrong, can be used to help human beings get onto the moon, that's pretty good. So that's the idea really of the least wrong, that we're always changing. You're always, you know, the change that we see each generation, the evolutionary changes that we see, all of them are just hope, you know, that idea that the best adapted for the time. And in the same way with science, what we have is we have ideas, which with everything we have available to us, this is the best answer we can come up with. So there is when people sometimes say that's wrong and that's wrong, there's an equality, there's not an equality in wrongness. Some things are definitely less wrong than others.
And I know you're also about to start on a comedy tour, the Pragmatic Insanity Tour. And this is your first time sort of being back on tour in a couple of years. The decision to go back out on the road, is there a different feeling this time around?
I think I'm not as insane as I was. I mean, that's almost why I put insanity in the title. There was a point where 2.5 years ago, when I stopped, I was having a great time when I was on stage, and the rest of my life I was slightly mad, I felt. And I would describe it as saying I hadn't gone insane, but I could see that the cracks in my sanity were wide enough for me to fall into. So I was having this incredible time of touring the US, touring Australia, playing to brilliant audiences, and yet being quite unhappy because I overdid it. This is a difficult thing. Sometimes I love doing stand-up, I love touring, but if you do it every single night of the week and you're always away from home and you spend every night in a different hotel room on your own with your brain just going, here are the voices, listen to all the voices, eventually that can be quite unhealthy. Whereas now, I mean, definitely by the time you get to next week and I'm in Toronto, I'll still be sane. So, you know, the audience will be secure by then. Perhaps by the end of January, the cracks in the sanity will have broadened out by then. But I'm also, I think by having taken quite a lot of time off to do other projects, I'm really excited by the ideas that I'm talking about. And I'm excited to get back on stage because I took a break. And that's an important thing. Sometimes, however much you love something and however great your job is, and I can tell you, talking rubbish every night, getting paid for it and meeting amazing people and getting to work with astronauts and epidemiologists and, you know, bicycle vandals and all of those different people, you know, that is a joyful thing to do. So you don't want to waste it by actually turning it into a chore.
Just to touch on sort of the religion that we talked about earlier, you mentioned that your favorite sketches of all time is Jesus versus Satan by a troupe called Big Train. What was it that stood out for you? Is it sort of that blend of the stupid and the ridiculous?
It's a beautiful sketch. I don't know how well you know Big Train at all. It's a great show. It was Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews, who in the UK are most famous for a series called Father Ted, about three Irish Catholic priests who live on a tiny little island called Craggy Island. They're very, very smart writers. And the sketch series, which had Simon Pegg in it as well, Simon Pegg, who Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and all of those things. And it was just this beautiful thing where Satan was basically this very banal Satan. He just worked in an office and he kept playing tricks on people. And Jesus just got annoyed with him, going, "Why have you done that, Satan? I'm going to have to let you go." And taking this great battle between Jesus and Satan and turning into someone who's just a bit of a dick in an office and going, "I'm really sorry, Satan. We can't work like this anymore. Well, I'm just trying to have fun." "Well, I'm sorry, Satan, it's not good enough." And the Big Train have this great way of taking, they would sometimes take great characters from science fiction movies and just have those moments when they're doing the hoovering around the house. So you have Ming the Merciless from Flash Gordon just doing a bit of hoovering.
Who makes you laugh?
I mean, I do genuinely still love watching Laurel and Hardy, and I think that Billy Connolly is, I might be an atheist, but I'm prepared to declare a comedy god, and I think that Billy Connolly remains one of the greatest stand-up comedian that's ever existed. And I went to see a screening of his most recent stand-up show, which is just a brilliant show, if you ever get a chance to see it, because he's not been well, he has He had early stages of cancer, prostate cancer, one. So he's very still now compared to he used to run around the stage and move with an incredible kind of vivacity. And now he's quite still, not that much movement, and yet he's lost none of his command. And he talks about being old so beautifully. There's a lovely sketch where he just talks about the fact he says people who eat brown bread to live longer. I don't know why they do that, because the bit of life they get, it's not the good bit that they're going to get. It's the rubbish bit. You know, brown bread people will just be. They'll be the ones who live. They'll come into me and they go, "Mr. Connolly, why are you crying again?" And they go, "Oh yeah, because all your friends are dead." Just, yeah, beautiful.
Well, you will be in Toronto on Thursday, January 11th, with Chris Hadfield at Roy Thompson Hall. Robin Ince, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Did that make any sense, though? I'm not sure I did. That's the problem with these things. I look back now and I think I could have had a much better answer on Ricky Gervais, I reckon. I could have just lied. I could have lied about the thing that would have annoyed him most, if I made up that he was involved in animal experiments. He does love his animals, so I could say that he was sending, you know, kind of various, you know, beagles around wax tubes in the hope of making a larger version of the Large Hadron Collider, but I didn't. So he's not that heavily involved with scientific advances at the moment.
Well, it was definitely an entertaining talk, and the city looks forward to having you next week.
Yeah, but why end it now? See, I think it's much more interesting if we do it now it's all finished. We should start. This is exactly the kind of rule breaking that needs to occur when you're involved in Generator with Chris Hadfield. I mean, that is a great thing. Have you? I presume you've interviewed Chris.
Yes, I've interviewed, not for this particular show, but I interviewed Chris a couple of years ago after he got back to Earth.
It is so much fun, isn't it? The first time that you kind of talk to an astronaut, and then you do have that little moment, don't you? And you go, "You've left the planet Earth. You've actually been in space." And I know it's you know, we haven't got that far in space, but I still find the excitement of working with astronauts. And I find I did the thing with Charlie Duke, who was Apollo 16, you know, a guy who's actually stood on the moon. And even at 48 years old, I am not in any way jaded by the idea of going, "There's a guy who's been on the moon. And there's a guy who's done a spacewalk. This is pretty cool." Anyway, yeah, you've got to finish it, haven't you? You've got other things to do. You've got interviews to do.
Well, you know, it's always nice to do a little pre and post chat, but yeah, no, this was great. Should air probably Tuesday.
Cool.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Thanks
very much. I'm sorry for the Skype hoopla.
No worries. Hey, I was just as lost as you were there for a minute.
Oh, that became very robotic at the end. I have no idea what that was. You froze.
Oh, I just said I just got very confused as you were for a minute there with Skype, so it's all good.
Good. We started confused. We end confused. Let us remain confused in an excited manner. Cheers, man. Thanks
Cheers.
Very much.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye-bye.
All too close for me to hardly recognize. But in focus, only see what I had left behind. I was 17, black Cadillac to a city where you never turn back. Had a debt so heavy, and I'm not gonna say everything was wrong. But it's the kind of ride you keep losing on. I ain't got nothing but fear now. Distance between love is real now. Pace with the pressure of fear now. Yeah.
War, and never let me go. Oh, never let me go. Playing with the sea like you got no name to it. Everything you want is a dream that I'll take from you. War, and never let me go.
Okay, black on black, black Cadillac. Baphomet on my ass. 666 on the dash. I'm running from my past, my future. Lucifer under my tubular Adidas. Jesus, my jeweler. Never needed a Jesus booster. Shine, I'm trying to find this place called Happy. My demons screaming at me. Don't DM or at me. I got 25 lighters on my dresser. And yes, sir, I'm fighting with this bitch named Depression. And guess what? All the windows are open. My navigation is broken. About to try this Cadillac in the ocean.
I ain't got nothing but fear now. Distance between love is real now. Faced with the pressure of fear now. Yeah.
War, and never let me go. Oh, and never let me go. Playing with the sea like you got no name to it. Everything you want is a dream that I'll take from you. War, and never let me go.
Sir. Turn away from the fatal thoughts. Can't wait from the shame I'm holding. It's all mine. Should it be all mine? Cut away every trace of angst, but still remain in a damaged place. I'm not alright. Should I be alright? Turn away from the fatal thoughts. Can't wait from the shame I'm holding.
Was another song by Traces. off of his new EP, Heart of Gold. That was the song Black Cadillac. And before that, you heard a great interview with Robin Ince from the BBC radio program Infinite Monkey Cage that he presents with physicist Brian Cox. Well, I've been talking about Traces since the beginning of the show. He's a new artist. He's only 20 years old, if you can believe it. Originally from San Diego and now living in Los Angeles. And he played a show here in town at the Drake a couple of nights ago. And it was a packed house, which is fantastic considering it's basically his first show in another country. And I think only the second or third time performing with his backup musicians. The EP is called Heart of Gold, and it fuses a lot of electronic stuff, pop, a little bit of hip-hop, and it's all about confusion, I think, and the duality of life. So this is my conversation with Traces. Traces, hello, welcome to Toronto.
Thanks for having me, man, I appreciate it.
How are you adjusting to our snowy weather?
It's not good at all. I saw that it was like, you guys do Celsius, right?
Yeah.
Celsius is your thing. In Fahrenheit, I saw that it was like only 3 degrees here.
Yeah.
That's some bullshit. Not for me. Yeah, not my thing.
Well, I know, you're from LA and there was fires and now there's mudslides going on.
Yeah, it's insane. Like, I was like right by our house too, because it was just like, there's a whole hill of fires like that. And then now it's like, there's no trees to catch any of it. So California has their own problems too.
You know, it's funny, whenever somebody says LA and California, you automatically think of films and Hollywood. But I think the music scene is underrepresented and doesn't necessarily get the praise and the press that it deserves. What do you like about the LA music scene?
Interesting. I never thought about that before with the film side of it and with music. But I think like the main thing for me is I'm not in love with the LA scene necessarily. I like the fact that there's opportunity and there's competition. Like, that's the two things that I really like about LA, is that it's competitive enough to make you have to be better. If you want to sound, stand out and sound different, it's like you have to push yourself to be able to get there, because everybody's talented. It's like, you know, you're not going to go to a venue and, like, meet somebody that's not good at their instrument, or, you know, whatever it means, or whatever that, you know, that is. But I think, yeah, I really like the fact that it's a lot of opportunity, meaning just, like, working with other people, writing with random producers, collaborators, whatever, but then also just like the competitive spirit, I think, is definitely a driving force for me.
I heard Dave Grohl say once that, you know, now we're in the age where anybody with a computer can make music. Mm. And, you know, having listened to your songs, you definitely have that, like, a little bit of that electro style. What do you make of that statement, and sort of how do you maybe counter the opinion of some people that electronic music maybe isn't as authentic as you know, the rock or the blues that we see out there?
Yeah, funny. Yeah, I think it comes down to your the heart behind the songs, because I think it comes down to concept. Is like, lyrically, what are you saying? I love pop music, and I love writing, and I do a lot of pop writing for other artists and stuff like that too, but I think that there's like a stigma that it has to be dumbed down to make it more palatable to audiences, and I don't think that that's how it has to be. I think as far as like authenticity goes, it comes down to like, where do you naturally go? What is like the natural movement of you writing music? Because I think for me, it's like, I don't always, I have a hard time like going into writing with like concepts and stuff like that. I kind of like to see like, here's what comes out, and then here's the sound that best tells that story. And so for me, it's kind of like, the electronic elements, it's like, I'm, I mean, I kind of agree to an extent with like shows and stuff like that. I'm a little tired of going to a show and just watching that everybody just push buttons, like it's only button pushing. There's something about a dude that knows his instrument, you know, that are like just, you know, is practice and put in the hours. But I think authenticity comes from what are you trying to say, how are you trying to say it, and is what you chose as far as like sonics go and sound goes, is what you chose to deliver that message real to you and natural? Is that sort of answer your question?
Yeah, and I think we are seeing a rebirth of pop music in a way. I mean, when I was a teenager in the early 2000s, and there was a lot of criticism that this pop music specifically was, you know, bland and artificial. And
sure.
You know, now I think we're seeing a rebirth, and to go back to what you said, the more authentic. Where do you think music has gone, you know, in the last few years since you started doing this, and where do you hope it will go?
Yeah, man, it's crazy. The one thing, like, I, since moving to L.A., because, I mean, I grew up in San Diego and did, like, band stuff and played in, like, kind of pop rock bands, like The Fray, One Republic, that kind of style. And then when I moved to L.A., it was kind of like rapid-fire learning. And the one thing I've learned through just 3 years of doing it full-time and being present and attentive is, like, it's always changing. Like, the stuff that I was trying to do 3 years ago is, like, doesn't work like now, as far as like release schedules with Spotify, iTunes, stuff like that. I think musically, I think we have artists like Frank Ocean, like Bon Iver, even like the Dua Lipas, which are like new rising pop stars that I think do have senses of commitment to concept and dialogue. It's like they're saying stuff in a unique way. I think my favorite music comes from people that found a way to say, find their voice essentially, and can say things different than anybody else in the world is. So it's like, this is this person speaking. And when I can like basically pick that out, that's kind of what I'm a fan of. And that comes like in a lot of different forms. I think Bon Iver has a unique tone as much as Black Bear does. And Black Bear, very different concepts, very different subject matter, type of thing. But yeah, I hope it continues with that. I really hope that there's a commitment to concept, and people push forward stuff rather than chasing trends necessarily.
You sort of touched on you know your writing process a little bit, and I know you don't necessarily go for concepts, but when you are writing, do you say like, oh, I'm gonna write a song about this specific topic, or does everything just sort of come out once you've got the music done?
Comes out. I am really for concepts, but concepts that come naturally. I just don't know, other people can do it. Like my buddy Isaiah is so good at just basically saying, this is what I'm writing about, and finding the perfect way of saying that. For me, it's like, I need to find my story. If it's like a Traces song, like I can definitely like, oh, here's a kind of a theme I can pull from experience and stuff like that. But it starts at what's the music kind of say. So like I love writing just piano vocal. Like that's where I kind of start at, finding the chords and kind of seeing what the story is from there, and then see what naturally comes out. And usually by I can go as long as I'm feeling the music. The minute that shuts off, it's really hard for me to get lyrics. It's like really tough. It's a lot more like brain math or whatever. But yeah, I think I like to see what is naturally coming out. And is there a theme there? Is there a concept there? In what I've already kind of been saying. I found at least that it's like, it's a way of self-checking myself, where it's like, here's where you're at, and here's what you've been thinking about, and here's what's on your mind. And then just being able to finish that thought with, you know, the skills of writing and music that we all pick up, I think it's really cathartic for me. And it's like, that's kind of where and why I do it, type of thing.
On the album's website, it states that the EP Heart of Gold is sort of about confusion that arises from being self-aware, and that you're aware of these things, super aware, but that it also leaves you with a sense of
longingness. Mm. How much of, for you, how much of that duality comes out in music?
Yeah, that's been the tough part, and I think that's like kind of what I'm trying to learn how to do. Is as far as like Heart of Gold in particular, it's like I was like not in a good spot, and so like I had a friend come to me. And he was just like, "You have an outlet, and not everybody has an outlet, and so use it." Essentially, I think being self-aware at the end of the day is very helpful, and like being aware of like, this is how I think about things, this is why I think about these things, and fortunately, like, not everybody gets the opportunity to actually do a self-checks like that. So I think it is really helpful, but it puts you in a place where you're like, you're constantly trying to figure things out. You're constantly trying to figure out, like, what's the right thing to do? Why do I feel this way? Is it because of this? Which kind of creates, like, another downward spiral where you just can't land anywhere. What do you mean by duality?
I guess because the description on the, you know, on the website, it was saying, you know, like there are certain songs on the album that are inspired about the confusion, mm-hmm. that comes with being self-aware, and the sort of the two sides that specific emotion brings.
Yeah, got it. Yeah. I think It's funny, the whole thing with even Traces and picking that as a name was like to have a sense of honesty, like to be able to put somebody at the... I heard Tyler Joseph from 21 Pilots put it in a way where he was like, he writes his albums by making a character and putting him at the end of the table so you can speak to him directly. And so that's kind of what I did with Traces, was try and create a character where... all of those thoughts can kind of be in a place and you can speak to them directly. So with that, it's like you have to have the confusion of constantly not knowing where you're at, why you're feeling the way you are. You have no way of fixing it. And then the other side of it is like, but then having to speak to it directly until it works itself out. I don't know. It's like growing up. I'm trying to learn it all. I'm definitely young and fully aware how young I am, and just trying to do my best.
Do you find yourself sort of, on a related note, getting distracted by your own thoughts?
Yeah.
And sort of that leads to sort of this more like, okay, let me just try to put everything in one place. Is there a certain way or tool that you use to try to harness all that into one direction?
Yeah, and I think it's not helpful. I think it's like not conducive to living a healthy life, if that makes sense. But essentially what I mean by that is I tend to just try and put myself and feel whatever I'm feeling so deeply that there's nothing really else that could come out. With that, if it's really intense sadness, you're gonna start feeling really intensely sad. If it's depression, you're gonna be really depressed. And I think it's hard to pull yourself back out from there. That's why I say it's not a healthy way of living. And I think that there's better ways of doing it, which I'm figuring out now. But yeah, I think it's like once I get what like the song's kind of trying to say with those initial lyrics and passes at it, I'm kind of like, let's dive into that. How do I feel about it? Have conversations. And that's what's been really helpful about like working with collaborators or other songwriters like Curtis Peoples. We like talk about it and we have like a conversation, and he knows me well enough to be also be like, yeah, you're also this way, so maybe you should take it from that angle and kind of like think about how's the story best told. Yeah.
The first single off the album is IDBH.
Yeah.
I Don't Belong Here.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that song?
Yeah, that was one of my favorites to write, for sure. That's one of the songs I'm most proud of. I think that song for me is like, if you want to know what Traces does or whatever, if you want to find what the sound is, it's that song. It has all the elements as far as like production wise and sonics goes. Has the pop rock elements that I grew up listening to, has all the hip hop elements that I love and study. It has electronic aspects to it, like you mentioned earlier. And then it has all the lyrical content that I think is like kind of what I want to say, and topically it's a topic that I like really proud of as well. That song we started writing, I had already like a version of it done. It was like a big long dragged out piano ballad thing that sounded awful, and I brought it in with my buddy Curtis and Colin, and Colin had a couple ideas just to kind of like make it a little bit bigger, and as soon as he did that, I was like, these verses are trash. And at the time, I had like a lot of social anxiety that I never had before. I've always been an extrovert. First time ever, no longer, like, it just like going into rooms of people I know and I'm panicked. Like, I was like, you know, like, feels like everybody's looking at you. Just kind of get stuck in your head. And I think that's kind of what I mean by the self-aware, like, confusion piece, where you're like, why in the world have I been an extrovert all my life? And all of a sudden, like, I'm having like paralyzing social anxiety. And so like, I kind of wanted to just like literally say it from the start, which is like, head up, smile to your crowd, eyes forward, hands down. It's like putting yourself in a position where it's like, don't look weird. I don't want to, like, don't pay attention to me. I'm normal. I fit in with everybody else. But then I think like there's aspect of like panic attack there where it's just like, I don't belong here. It's like, I don't, yeah, it's like, I don't, whatever this moment is, it's like, it's just like kind of destructive. And I think that was a good idea for where I was at in life as well at the time.
You know, we all, especially as young people, we all want to feel like we fit in.
Sure.
And society often tries to put us in certain groups or, you know, put us in certain boxes. But is there a certain sense of satisfaction, or, you know, maybe a certain sense of belonging, finding out that you don't necessarily belong anywhere?
Is there a belonging and not belonging anywhere?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
For me, no. I wish, like, I really wish that was the case, but I don't. I always wanted to be, I covered a little bit this on the EP as well, like, I grew up, I mean, especially in high school, I just watched Hot 97 interviews, which is just like a really popular hip-hop station in New York, and I would just watch like Jay-Z, come on, and Birdman from Young Money, and you just see all these people that are so self-confident, like, or it's like, wow, you guys really don't need anybody else in your life in the entire world. I was like, oh, that's gonna be me. Like, I'm gonna be like, Mr., I'm I don't know, I'm cool, I'm ahead of the curve, whatever it was, like, whatever the artsy douchebag thing is, that I was like, maybe that will work out for me, maybe that will help. And dude, I just like was like, I'm bored, like, I don't have any friends that way, you know. It's like, you want to be around people, and it's like, I think it's a mistake to not be invested in other people's lives, as much as, like, you know, it's helpful for yourself to have friends, you should be investing in them. And so I think, for me, it's like more about stating honestly where I'm at, and for me to understand where I'm at, like, it's that self-awareness or whatever in a place where now I can understand it, and then I can also now go talk to friends about it and talk to those people. But yeah, I wish I was all alone on my little island and felt so secure in that. Just, yeah, not me. I wish I was Jay-Z, just not totally me. He has his wife and kids. He's
right.
He's chilling.
Yeah,
he's good.
Yeah, I don't think he has anything to worry about.
Yeah. Sure.
Your manager was joking that he was gonna share some embarrassing stories with me. Do you wanna preempt him?
Man.
Is there any story about yourself or him that?
Pardo. I hate that you just brought this up, by the way. Man, what would he go to? I don't. Oh, this was so annoying. So, I've been getting on his case for the last couple weeks, because there's this company that I've worked with in the past that, like, they give me free watches every once in a while, and all of a sudden I saw one of his other bands that he manages with just all the same watches, and they're like promoting them on social media and stuff like that, and they were one of my favorite bands as a kid, and I was just like, you know, I was like, what did I say? It's just along the lines of like, it's the worst when you see your childhood brand or your favorite childhood bands steal your brand deals. And so I'm calling him out in front of all our people downstairs, and he decides to tell everybody about the extensive number of fender benders that I've been in, and that's just what he goes to. He uses Curtis and me, are both managed by him, and he says every like slight to Pardo, if you want to diss him, it's just an opportunity to get you back. So I wish I had some like crippling dirt on him, but just for my own safety, I'm gonna keep it clean. Yeah, for the most part.
Speaking of the watches, is that another sort of, I guess, aspect of your career that you're getting used to, is being used as sort of a marketing tool and you know, as an image for these different companies? How do you deal with that?
I'm too new to give you like an accurate answer. If anybody wants to give me a brand deal and send me free stuff, I'm super down. Oh, super down. I'll sell out so quick. No, but I don't know. I'm cool with it, man. I think, as of right now, my stuff's too emo and dark for any, like, happy brands to be down with. But I love fashion. Like, I love clothes. I spend way too much time looking at that stuff, too. And so, I want to get into that a little bit more as well. Like, a little bit more into fashion design. That's kind of becoming a bigger part of what we do. And, like, we'll start rolling some stuff out like that pretty soon. As far as, like, I don't know, being used as a marketing tool, I just haven't really, like, enough. I like having a free watch, I'll say that, down, for sure. I don't know, as long as it's, like, consistent with things I believe in and, like, you know, helps them out, helps me out, it'd be cool. Yeah, all good.
Would you say you have a favorite track off of Heart of Gold?
IDBH.
IDBH.
I think at the end of the day, it's IDBH. For a while, it was Black Cadillac. That song, it's just a special. Like, it was just so fun working on that with the other guys that are on it too. But I kind of go between Trouble in Mind, which is the first song, and then IDBH. Those are kind of the two that I always lean between. I like the soundscape and I like the story. I think they're just interesting and they don't sound like everything else to me. So just kind of proud of those two. Yeah, that's kind of my two favorite.
All right, well, the album is Heart of Gold. Traces, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Once again, that was my conversation with Traces. His debut EP is out now. And that is it for the show today. Thanks to Traces and thanks to Robin Ince. You're going to want to download the show on Tuesday. I have a very, very feature length interview with Christian Picciolini, who is the author of White American Youth, which is about his time as a young white nationalist in his teens and early 20s before he left and renounced the movement in the mid-90s. We're going to take you out with Trouble in Mind by Traces. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Same old house with the same old holes. Run away, keep from what you don't know. Yeah. Waking to a lonely house every morning. Keep out of the pressure, separated from the old me. Yeah. You save yourself, forsake your own. I'm barely saving the fate. I'm fading from my pain. Can I stay myself alone? Leave the warmness to the fold. Impatient with the pain.
way I can say I'm selfish, hey. I can't stand the crying, bended by the silence. Hear the lies I never wanted to, oh, no, 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 yeah. I'll save yourself, I'll save you.